Hello, my name is Jacqueline Serrano, and this is interview number 2 of 2 as part of the 150 Years of Women at Berkeley series for the Department of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. Interview number 1 was conducted with Clementina Duron, Estela Quintanilla, Lineda Warjack, Leah Ibarra, Maria Ramirez, Nina Geneta, and Victoria Wong. If you would like to watch or listen to that interview first, please visit ethnicstudies.berkeley.edu for more information. Today's interview will be a solo interview with Teresa Loya Asturias, a member of the original Third World Liberation Front of 1969. Okay, so if you would, could you please introduce yourself?
Yes. So my name is Teresa Loya Asturias. Mm-hmm. I was part of the 1969 original Third World Liberation Front, along with Isidro Macias, Manuel Delgado, and many others.
I remember you said you'd like to start with question number 10.
So as far as the legacy of the Third World Liberation Front, I believe that we were part of a revolution of the 60s. There was a period of time in the 60s where there was much movement among young people, many activities and movements going on, including the fight against Vietnam, the civil liberties, as well as the women's movement, the farm workers movement was going on. And there was just a change in the attitudes of young people. Change in the music scene with people like Bob Dylan, rising people's consciousness, an interest in political change, and people's determination to make their lives different from that of their parents and not following their parents' footsteps, but defining their own culture and their ideals. So it was very stimulating. There was lots of activity and many people got involved in not just one, but many, many different movements, including the fight against the Vietnamese War, the Farm Workers Union, and working with Cesar Chavez, fighting for the right to for the farm workers to unionize, and the right for people of color to be able to express their beliefs and be written in a way that accurately and honestly reflects our contribution to society and our role in society and our histories. Because up until that time, most history books excluded the histories of people of color. And so I think that it was the beginning of a revolution that has, in many ways, have changed the world in the way young people's attitudes were at the time. And it still is vibrant today.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm gonna jump to question number 1.
Okay.
About how did the TWLF movement come about and what was your role?
Well, I was one of the worker bees. I was one of those who was in favor of our going on strike for the reasons I just mentioned. And I don't think I was a leader in so much as one of the cadre of people who were involved. The leadership was mostly Isidro. He was the president of MAST. And Manuel Delgado, they were the two major leaders. Richard Rodriguez was also very much involved. But there was conflict. It's been many years, so I don't remember all the details. But there was a conflict and some dissatisfaction with our joining the Third World Strike and going on strike and what it was going to mean to our futures, our careers, our grades, potential violence at the university. But many of us believed strongly that we had to make this stand and force the university to recognize us and recognize our history and our contribution to the world and to mm-hmm. society.
When it came to gathering people for the strikes, do you recall how people found one another and how did this community form and build?
We usually would gather around Sager Gate and we didn't have cell phones at the time, but there was a way of keeping in touch with one another. And we always had a designated spot where we would meet each morning and everyone knew where that spot was. And then there were multiple meetings going on in the evening among the leaders and deciding how to move forward for the next day and plans for the next day.
What did those meetings look like? Would people kind of just filter in to those meetings or was it like a word of mouth type thing?
Usually the leaders of the various ethnic groups, the Chicano leaders, the Asian leaders, the Native American leaders, and the African American leaders would gather and have their meetings, and then they would bring back information to the larger group within their respective cohort. So Isidro and Manuel and Richard would meet with the entire leadership group, and then they would bring back the information and share it with the rest of us. We were meeting on a regular basis because we weren't ready classes. at the time, so we were having regular meetings.
Can you talk about any hardships you faced as a woman of color in the movement?
Well, I never felt discriminated against. Maybe I was too naive to recognize it. I was always a hard worker, and I excelled in my classes, which surprised myself and most of the people in my family. I'm the first one to have gone to college. So I don't really feel like there were people discriminated against me as a woman or as a woman of color, at least not on the campus. I have felt it in other situations. Perhaps, for example, in trips to Texas, I felt discriminated against, but never in my hometown of Los Angeles or as I was going to college, junior college or state college or university, UC Berkeley or UC Davis. I always felt like my word was respected as much as anyone else's, and my opinions.
That's great. I believe that the women from the previous interview group said the same thing, that they were also, they felt very much protected and respected amongst like the TWLF cohort as well. So with that, I'll ask, how did gender dynamics play a role in the work that went into the strikes? How did this contribute to the collective, and how did this influence interpersonal relationships?
Well, as has already been mentioned, I believe that we were respected and given as much voice as anyone else, as the males in the group. But as it turned out, the leadership was mostly male. And I don't think it was because they were discriminating against the women. It was just, that's the way it was at the time. So I don't feel that the males were in charge, and they were the ones that were in the front lines and making the decisions. But I don't think it was had anything to do with their lack of respect for women or feeling superior to women.
Can you talk more about your role? You mentioned that you were kind of a worker bee. So what did those day-to-day activities look like?
Well, we would usually meet, I think, around 8 or 9 o'clock around Sager Gate. And we were marching in a circle, and then as a group enlarged and more people became involved, because a lot of people who were not of ethnic groups also joined our marching. There was quite a bit of sympathy for our cause, both among the professors as well as many students. So it became larger and larger. I honestly don't remember the violent parts of it, but I do recall that Reagan sent in, as he was governor of California at the time, he sent in the National Guard at one point, and there were violent episodes. I do remember being gassed or maced. What is the gas that they use for dispersing crowds?
Tear gas.
Tear gas. I remember once having that and running up the street to try to avoid it. The recollection that it's been 50 years, so I don't really remember the specifics of it.
Yeah, I imagine so. Thank you very much for sharing that. So for the next question, could you talk about a woman in the movement that you feel served as a source of inspiration during that time or following that?
I would have to say Lenaida Means stands out as the woman who was the most vocal and who stood out. There were very few Native American students on campus. I think she was one of less than 5. There were very few. I think there were just a handful of Native American students at the time, and she was one of the leaders. She was very articulate, and she was always up there with the guys, standing proud and willing to take the blows. She's a very strong lady.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. Lenaida is a very, very powerful woman, a very strong woman. Thank you so much for sharing that. And if I may move on to the next question, what did you imagine to be the outcome of the strike?
Well, I had hoped that there would be a true third world college, and that each ethnic group, Latino, Native American, Asian, and Black, would have their own departments within the third world college. But apparently that's not how it ended up, which is a little saddening. And I understand there have been other efforts to decrease the budget for third world studies. And there was another uprising in 1999, which you probably know more about than I do. So I believe that ultimately my outlook and the outlook of those of us who were involved, it did not reach the conclusion we had expected and hoped for in terms of the department itself. So now, as I understand it, there's just ethnic studies. There isn't a department like a Chicano studies, Latino studies department. There isn't a African American studies department or Native American or Asian. It's all under one umbrella.
There is an ethnic studies department, and then there is an African American studies department, which is a separate entity, although in some cases they do operate together. And so under the Ethnic Studies Department branch, you have Chicano Studies, you have Asian American and Asian Diaspora Studies, and Native American Studies. So all of those are under the Ethnic Studies
But
branch.
they have their own chief or leadership.
Yes, so there's the department chair of ethnic studies, which is Juana Maria Rodriguez. And then for each of the sub-departments, there are department heads, but I do believe that they are more for administrative purposes.
So there are sub-departments all under the umbrella of ethnic studies.
Yes.
So what happened to the Third World Liberation Front or college, which is what we had imagined?
Ended up being the Ethnic Studies
I
Department and ended up being the African American Studies Department. And in 1999, there were cuts to ethnic studies. And that's where the 1999 strikes came in.
And then ultimately, the university agreed to keeping ethnic studies and to also starting a gender studies center.
Yeah, so following the 1999 strikes, part of the agreement that they had was that they would establish a center for race and gender. So, yes, that is still in existence today.
I see. Okay. And how many students has ethnic studies given degrees to in the last since 1969? Is it how many, is there like a limited number of students that can get their bachelor's degree per year?
That's a great question. I would not be able to answer your question as to how many students have received a bachelor's degree from the Ethnic Studies Department. That would be a great question for Laura Jimenez Olvera or for Dewey St. Germain, our undergraduate advisors. But I do know that in 2019, there were 99 bachelor's degrees given out to ethnic studies students. Yeah.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah, it's a really great community. So let's move on to the next question. What was the climate towards the TWLF folks with respect to the rest of the UC Berkeley campus in regards to students, workers, and professors? I know that previously you mentioned that the non-Black, Indigenous, and POC students on campus were sympathetic to the movement.
Yes, I would say so. I did not feel any animosity. I felt that there was a lot of sympathy towards our cause, and I felt no hatred at all on campus during the movement. Now, that's all I can really say. It doesn't seem to, it just, there was more, they were curious and sympathetic rather than antagonistic towards our cause and our movement.
That's great. Yeah.
And that goes along with the mentality of people in the 60s becoming more open-minded and more willing to accept people of color.
Were you a part of any other movements at the time, or did you put most of your focus into TWLF?
Well, most of it was work, primarily trying to get my degree. I did attend demonstrations against the Vietnam War. Most of us did. I did attend demonstrations and movements for the Farm Workers Union. That was an active group on campus. So I participated in those movements as well.
Did you feel that working as part of the movement affected your studies, or were you willing to let your studies kind of be pushed a little bit to the side in order to continue fighting for the
Well,
movement?
unfortunately, during that semester, I had been on the dean's list, honor list, up until that semester. But unlike some of my colleagues who went around and talked to their professors and arranged to do their studies on the side, I didn't do that. So I just stopped going to class because I thought that's what we were supposed to do if we were on strike. You don't make arrangements to work with your professors on the side. So I ended up getting all Fs that semester. It did affect my GPA. I was never again on the dean's list. I was never able to bring my GPA up above a B. But nevertheless, because of my involvement in the movement and because of my interest in helping the underserved, I was still able to get into medical school. I worked also with, I don't know if you're familiar with David Hayes Bautista. He got a PhD at UC Berkeley in School of Public Health, and he wrote a grant when I was there as an undergraduate, and he got funding to start a Clínica de la Raza in East Oakland. Well, David Hayes Bautista is the one who started it, and I worked very closely with him because I had been in the Peace Corps. I worked in a TB sanitarium in Africa. So I ran the TB program at the Clínica de la Raza, and I also interpreted for some of the doctors who came in as volunteers to see patients. And Clínica de la Raza is still in existence and it's thriving from what I understand. So that's one of the movements that I was involved in. I feel very proud that I was involved in that movement. It's on Fruitvale Avenue in East Oakland.
I'm also curious about any community work, like the ones you just mentioned, any community work that you've done or any movements that you were a part of after having graduated. Like, how did being part of TWLF movement stay with you?
Absolutely. When I was an undergraduate, or when I was in medical school at UC Davis, we had a program where people, students volunteered to go work with farm workers in the camps for the farm workers, and we would do physical exams on Saturday morning. So I was very involved in that. I did that almost every weekend. And then after finishing my medical school and residency in internal medicine, and then doing a pathology residency as well, I became aware of the great number of women in Latin America and in Africa and Southeast Asia who die from cervical cancer. The rate here in the United States is far less, and it's primarily because women in these countries don't have access to preventive care. For example, in Latin America, the number one cause of death, cancer deaths among women under the age of 50 is from cervical cancer. So I wrote a grant along with some help from Fred Dominguez and a few other people at Martin Luther King Hospital and Drew University. We wrote a grant and we got funding from Bill Gates Foundation, and we were able to start a cervical cancer screening program. I took about 20 volunteers from around the country, including Arizona and Connecticut, pathologists, gynecologists, cytopathologists. There was one cytopathologist from Mexico who joined us. They were all volunteers. And in 2003, we did a cervical cancer screening campaign in Guatemala. We screened over 500 women for cervical cancer, and we provided a treatment for women who were found to have dysplasia or cancer. We worked alongside one of the host NGO host organizations in Guatemala. And after we left, before we left, we trained a nurse practitioner who continued doing Pap smears, and we arranged for the Pap smears to be interpreted by a cytopathologist. All of this was coordinated. So by the end of a few years, we had screened over 5,000 women.
Wow.
It was so successful that I was asked to do it again in Guatemala in another Indian village called Chichicastenango. And we were going to do that in 2005. However, and I had the same volunteers coming with me from all over the country, including Mexico. And Hurricane Stan hit just a few days before we were to leave. So we had to postpone the trip. And what we ended up doing was bringing a Guatemalan doctor. She was an internist, and we trained her. We brought her to the United States, and with the help of the American Cancer Society, we trained her at various universities on how to do Pap smears, how to do colposcopies, and physical examination and questionnaires. And she went back to Chichicastenango and did the work that we would, had intended doing. Then in 2007, we did another campaign in Belize. The Ministry of Health in Belize invited us, my same group, to go to Belize and do a similar project there. We screened close to 600 women in Belize for cervical cancer. So these are some of the projects that I've been involved in, and very proud to have been helping women in these Latin countries get screened and protected against cervical cancer.
That's absolutely amazing.
It took about a year each time with each project. It was tons of work, but I do have presentations on cervical cancer screening and different methods for treatment and stuff like that. And I've made many presentations. And I'm not sure if they're available on the internet because people tell me there's a lot of information about the things that I've done on the internet. I have never looked at myself up there, but that's what I hear.
One of my questions was kind of referring back to the previous interview that we had where the women from the Latina cohort were talking about how the Latina women were working very, very hard behind the scenes, and the women that were part of the TWLF movement in the respective cohorts were all working very, very hard. Could you give some input on that?
Well, I do recall when Isidro was jailed and injured by the police, there was a group of us Latinas who got together. It wasn't just the Latinas, it was the Filipino students, the Asian students, and the African American students. We put together like a concert that took place in Oakland. We rented a building and we had ethnic food and we had dancers and people, musicians, and we raised several thousand dollars. And that was an effort that was put together by mostly women. And all the money went towards Isidro's legal fees.
Yeah, I, that's not a story that I'd heard before.
Yeah, we did have one fundraising event where thousands of people came, raised money.
It was the concert that was the fundraising event?
Yes, it was a fundraiser primarily for Isidro's legal fees. And it involved all the ethnic groups. We had music and we had dancers, Filipino dancers, mariachi music, folklorico, ballet folklorico. It was a lot of fun. There was just one other thing. Are you aware that I married Oswaldo Asturias, who was the initial chairperson for the Latino portion or Chicano portion of the Ethnic Studies program?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's even written in the history, but he came to us, to the members of the MASC group, Mexican American Student Confederation. Isidro was our president, and he spoke to us about the movement that was taking place at San Francisco State, because I believe they started their strike before we did. And I believe he helped to implement and our movement forward for the students in MASC to become involved in the Third World Strike.
Oh, okay.
Because of his involvement. And he became the first chairperson. I think Juan Martinez became the second when we moved out of Berkeley area in 1972, when I started at UC Davis. But he was president for at least a year. We married in 1973, somewhat controversial because a lot of the Chicanos felt that the chairman should be a Chicano rather, and he was Latino, having been born in Guatemala, but his heart was in the same place, and he understood the dynamics of people of color and the stresses and the problems that they face in the greater society. But it's a shame he's not written down somewhere in your history. So you weren't even aware that he was the initial chairperson for the department of, for the Latin. See, there was a controversy about whether it should be called Chicano Studies or Chicano Latino Studies. And a lot of the Chicanos had this focus that they should be only be on Chicanos and not have a worldview of the struggle of people around the world. I think it was a little narrow for them to think it should only be Chicano Studies. And Manuel Delgado wrote a book, The Last Chicano. Does he truly believe he's the last Chicano? Have you read his book?
Have not, no.
Oh, I see. Well, I was a little offended. I mean, why does he think he's the last Chicano? I mean, many of us still identify as Chicanos, and when we're asked to fill out paperwork, we still have the opportunity to say we're Chicano in a lot of documents that we write and fill out daily. So it was somewhat controversial at the time whether there should be a Chicano as the chair or a Latino, whether it should be Chicano Studies or Latino Studies. But I think ultimately it became Chicano / Latino, and that's the way it should be.
Yes, yeah.
Latinos, as much as Chicanos. I mean, the Latinos that have come to the United States, like your own parents, they also have had struggles that they've had to deal with. We have to have a broader view.
Yeah, absolutely. As Latinx people, many of us do have a common experience in the U.S., though, of course, it can be nuanced. And you are correct, it did become Chicano and Latino Studies. So you said that you met Oswaldo through the movement because he was speaking to you guys about the events that were taking place in San Francisco at the
Yes. And then ultimately we married.
Do you know of any other instances where within the movement, these kinds of relationships came about where people were convening about strikes and then they formed like different kinds of relationships, like interpersonal relationships?
Well, like Isidro and his wife, Veronica, their relationship blossomed during the Third World Strike. Clementina and her husband, Tomas, their relationship also blossomed during the Third World Strike.
Very much like a matchmaker type thing.
Yes. Brought us together through a struggle, a common struggle that we all identified with.
So for question number 9, are you still in regular contact with your peers from that time?
Yes. Well, with some of them, I'm in contact with Clementina Duran. I was her maid of honor at her wedding. And I'm in touch with Isidro Macias. He's my compadre. I baptized his second son, Quetzalcoatl, and his wife, Veronica, baptized my son, Jose Oswaldo.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And Isidro and Veronica are good friends of ours, and they've been for many years. My husband and I were responsible for Isidro choosing to move to Hawaii. We traveled with Isidro and Veronica on several occasions. On vacation, we went to Jamaica 1 year. Another year, we talked them into going to Hawaii. And he was a successful lawyer in Fresno at the time. And on our last few days in Hawaii, he announced at dinner that he was going to move to Hawaii. And he told Veronica, if you want to, you and the kids want to come with me, that's fine. Otherwise, I'll move here by myself. So ultimately, he moved to Hawaii and became a very successful businessman. So we're still in touch.
I believe we've gone through all of the questions already, but I would love to hear if you have anything else to say about being part of the TWLF movement and anything that stayed with you. And I would like to reiterate again, like, what you feel is the legacy of the movement today and how that's affected you and others, et cetera.
Well, I believe that because of our movement, it rebounded around the country, around the world. And I think that because of our willingness to take a chance, to step up and to be willing to speak about the need for social change and political awareness among third world people, and the fact that they, as a group, if you stand up, you can bring about change by working together as a group and not being afraid to speak out. So I believe that this has impacted not just the small community of the Bay Area, but I think it's reverberated around the world.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Teresa, for taking the time to speak with me and
thank you.
Sharing your history as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Appreciate it.